Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by ISOS Connect. Modernize your private practice without tech overwhelm. Create and store client records and notes. Schedule video sessions with automated confirmations and reminders. Send invoices and more. All in one secure, affordable, and easy to use place. Visit www.isosconnect.com and use code TC30 for 1 month free on any paid plan.
Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast, a podcast for therapists by therapists.
Welcome to another episode of the Therapist Connect podcast. My name is Dr. Peter Blundell, and today I'm delighted to be interviewing Sam Hope. Sam is a seasoned trainer, author, counsellor, and consultant with person-centered anti-oppressive values. They're a highly rated trainer on gender, sexual and romantic diversity, neurodiversity, disability and anti-oppressive practice. They are a person-centered therapist and clinical supervisor that understands the systemic factors that impact our lives. Sam is also an author of the book Person-Centered Counseling for Trans and Gender Diverse People, a practical guide and much more besides. If you enjoyed this episode of the Therapist Connect podcast, please leave us a review on your favourite podcast platform. Sam, thank you so much for coming on the Therapist Connect podcast. It's lovely to meet you, and I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy hearing a little bit about your life and work.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So the question I ask everybody, I think it's a good kind of opening question to kind of get us started, is what drew you to become a therapist in the first place?
Gosh, happy accident, really. So I was studying chemistry as a mature student in my mid-20s when I became chronically ill with what originally they thought it was post-viral fatigue syndrome, then they said ME, then CFS, and now it's fibromyalgia. But it's, you know, sort of that kind of stable of chronic illness. And I became very ill, had to drop out of university, couldn't work. And I started doing evening classes just as a way of getting back into the world again. And I did an introduction to counselling course, having had therapy at university and found it very helpful, and I just got hooked. It was absolutely a sort of not a kind of plan to become a therapist. I did that, and then I did my certificate, and then I was like, I think I'll go on, and on I went, and then so I qualified in 2004. So I've been a therapist for 20 years now.
Amazing. It's really interesting. It's sort of similar journey to me in terms of I hadn't planned to be a therapist, and so did that kind of introductory course and then absolutely loved it and just kind of carried on with it. So it's there's something in there, isn't it? It kind of captures something. So 20-year career, so that's quite a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've done over that period of time?
So I started off as a school counsellor, and I also sort of early career, and also did a stint as a counselling coordinator for a domestic violence service. And so the two strands of my career ended up being counselling and education. So I went on to be university counsellor and counselling survivors, which is something that I still do a lot of now. But since about 2016, I've been solely in private practice, and I do about half of my working week as a therapist, and the other, well, a therapist and supervisor, I should say, and the other half as a trainer. So I do an awful lot of what people call EDI training. I'd like to call it anti-oppressive training, but working on it, sort of upskilling people around best practice, around access, inclusion, etc.
Amazing. So much different work. How was it doing school-based counselling and then kind of, it sounds like, adult work as well? So do you still do both types now, or?
I still see a few young people. I don't see so many in private practice, but I mean, there's a real demand for it. But it's it's more challenging working with young people because of the autonomy issues that young people have. But yeah, so I don't think I could do solely working with youngsters, but I like to keep a small amount of my practice working with youngsters.
Amazing. So could you tell us a little bit more maybe about your anti-oppressive practice work and the training that you do?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm actually working on an e-learning at the moment that sort of just looks at actually how we sort of do anti-oppressive therapy from a person-centered perspective. And really, I've been trying to help people understand the relational aspects of anti-oppressive practice, that often when we are sort of failing marginalized folks is because we're failing to empathize with marginalized folks, we're failing to build relationship to marginalized folks. And often what happens in the dynamics within workplaces, within the therapy room, is that we're inserting our own stories about that person, or we're, inserting sort of our cultural indoctrination around, ideas about that person in between us and them. And it's sort of getting in the way of us actually meeting that person. So an awful lot of what I do, I train around mental health and disability, trans, LGBT, and then sort of more generally on anti-oppressive practice and things like beyond unconscious bias and that sort of thing. So, yeah, what I'm generally trying to do is sort of wake people up to the idea of what they don't realise they're doing, what they're not aware they're inserting in between them and other people when they think they're in relationship. And often there's lots of sort of hidden hierarchies and sort of hidden assumptions going on that we kind of just need to bring into our awareness. So I think therapists doing this work is quite useful because it's about relationship and it's about awareness. So that's kind of why it's become a big thing for me. And obviously I do a lot around, because I'm a trans person myself, I do a lot around helping people unlearn the things they think they know about trans people, which is unfortunately an awful lot at the moment, sort of misinformation going around. So I do quite a lot of that work too.
That's really interesting. I was thinking from a person-centered perspective, I think how little I think is written from an anti-oppressive place, which I think is really problematic that we haven't kind of ventured there and kind of haven't got many people kind of talk. Well, we've got people talking about it, but maybe not people writing about it and doing kind of some of the training. And the other thing I was thinking about as well is sometimes that risk with person-centered, and particularly in training, of that idea of, oh, we're being empathic, we've got UPR, therefore, where as the therapist, we're okay, we're doing everything we possibly can, for the client in front of us. And it's like, yes, but actually we could not be empathizing, because the stuff that we don't know or we don't understand or is out of our awareness, actually we're not connecting with it. And that's the learning edge, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we could be in a state of incongruence because we don't know what we don't know, and we don't realize that we are inserting our own ideas into the relationship. So there's this this idea that the person-centered core conditions can be just switched on very, very easily. And I don't think people realize just how much work it is to get past their own kind of cultural stereotypes and indoctrination to really meet the client. So yeah, I would say person-centered is and that it isn't always as possible as we think it is when we're working across difference. And I think the sort of obliviousness of the kind of person-centered approach to that is a shame, because ultimately person-centered is supposedly about power inequalities in the room and dismantling hierarchy between therapist and client. And that, that to me is the heart of person-centered practice. And if people aren't actively doing that and actively understanding the hierarchies present and the power inequalities present in society, then there's a whole lot that they're just oblivious to that's going on in the room that they're not noticing. And so I don't really understand why we're not much more hot on antidepressant practice, except that, you know, Carl Rogers was of his time and he was kind of oblivious. You know, if you watch him counselling African-American client, you can see how he was oblivious to some of the stuff that was going on there and some of the power inequalities going on there.
Absolutely. I completely agree with all of that. And I think sometimes people assume that those issues of addressing power are within the theory, and they are within the theory, but then we also have to actively work at that as well. And I don't think we've done a very good job of discussing that in the person-centered community and looking at the challenges and the difficulties that we face as person-centered therapists. So I'll be looking out for your training as it when it arrives.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think we've got a lot of work to do on this. And, you know, as a profession, it's a whole profession issue. I just think person-centered ought to be better. But actually, I think the therapy profession is probably 20 years behind social work. And that's a real shame because, you know, we can definitely stand to do better, especially when it's often marginalised folks who are going to be coming to see us because they're under extra stress.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there is really something important in that, in thinking about the therapy profession and how far we've still yet to go compared to some other professions that are based on kind of social justice and empowering people. So, no, I completely agree. So as well as doing training around kind of LGBT and trans issues, you've also written a book, which is from a person-centered perspective, The Person-Centered Counseling for Trans and Gender Diverse People, A Practical Guide. For anyone out there who's not read it, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what motivated you to write it? I suppose we've kind of hinted at that already a little bit, and what they can expect from the book.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I really loved writing the book. And I mean, what motivated me to write it was the publisher getting in touch, having read a blog that I'd written. I gave a presentation at De Montfort University and they thought my take on person-centered, exactly what I was just talking about, the sort of person-centered sort of approach to working with diversity, they thought, oh, that would make a good book. So I did a pitch and wrote the book. But my intention when I wrote it was to write something that was really accessible, really easy, so that, you know, clients pick it up sometimes as well. Trans people pick it up and find it sort of helpful in understanding themselves. So it's a real kind of basic ABC of trans, but not in any way dumbed down in the sense of like trying to reduce it to there's one kind of trans person or there's, you know, it's really, really simple to understand what a trans person is, really kind of holding the complexity, but using simple language, using sort of, you know, sort of nice, straightforward, clear, self-reflective, so the reflective bits at the end of each chapter. And, you know, have you thought about this, you know, aspect of gender? Have you thought about what it would be like to work with this particular kind of client? So it's that sort of very, yeah, practical, tangible, concrete, these are the sorts of things you can do. And the other thing that I really wanted to do was to bring in all of the other strands of intersectionality. So it also speaks to gender inequality in general. It speaks to colonialism and racism and ableism, and gives a reasonable framework for also thinking about anti-oppressive practice. So hopefully if somebody reads this, it will also make them think about other aspects of their practice as well as working with trans people. So that's kind of what I wanted to do. I think that I achieved that. I think it's sort of, it's, you know, it's not a thick book. There's not a lot to wade through, but hopefully it's quite a thoughtful book and it'll get people thinking differently about the ways that they practice. And also, you know, sort of maybe getting people thinking differently about their processes of thinking about their own gender as well.
Yeah, it's really good. It's great reflections in there. And I know we recommend it on all the different person-centered courses that I've teach on or have taught on in the past. So if anyone's not read it, go and grab a copy. I wondered, as we're shifting topic slightly a little bit, I'm wondering how you see the wider therapy community and how kind of connected that you feel to other therapists within the profession.
There's a question. I have found it difficult since coming out as trans. I think prior, when people perceived me as a lesbian cisgender person, I found it relatively comfortable. I didn't face a lot of discrimination, but since coming out as trans, I have faced a lot of discrimination in a lot of contexts and really concerning stuff. And I think I was surprised by that. I think I was surprised to see that there's a particular difficulty maybe with, and I think there are other, you know, this isn't exclusive to being trans. I'm also a neurodivergent person. I also see it towards neurodivergence that maybe because we come from a profession that deals with sort of ideas of psychopathology, and neurodivergence and transness have both been perceived as psychopathology, that maybe there is this sort of idea that a trans and neurodivergent person can't be a therapist, that there is something wrong with being this kind of a person, in a way that I suppose would have happened very much and still happens a bit for gay people, but not as much. So, you know, if you go back 10 years, 20 years, people thought homosexuality was a mental illness, and I guess gay therapists weren't having an easy time of it. And I'm not saying it's all roses, but it's definitely got better. So yeah, I think there is that sort of, there is still this sort of understanding of you're the kind of person who is client, not therapist. You are very much in a one-town position in society, and what are you doing? Treating yourself as an equal. And I've had a lot of infantilizing attitudes and just generally being patronized, as well as just shocking levels of transphobia that reflect the society that we're in right now, where, you know, we've got a prime minister who is spouting ridiculous nonsense about trans people, and trans people are really a very much scapegoated minority currently. So I guess, you know, that's where we are, and the profession unfortunately reflects that, but it's kind of hard.
I mean, I'm really sad to hear that, but I'm not surprised. I think within the Therapist Connect community and on our social media platforms, some of the things that we have to try and manage, or some of the worst things that we have to try and manage, is transphobia from within the profession, and how some therapists conduct themselves online talking about trans issues. It's really difficult. So yeah, I'm very sorry that you've had to experience that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I had to leave the BACP because of transphobia. I've can't really be in sort of like mainstream like Facebook groups and stuff like that, because, you know, you will inevitably come across people's sort of entitlement to tell you that you don't understand your own experience, that trans people aren't real, that, you know, it's usually some flavor of trans people aren't real, trans people don't exist. You're completely mistaken that trans people are a real thing, and 100 years of research on trans people, it's all nonsense. Trans people just don't exist. And yeah, it gets tiring pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's exhausting, and it's particularly in the news and social media, it's kind of like a non-stop onslaught at the moment of people debating other people's lives and identities when it's not even related to their own experience.
And again, I mean, it goes back to what I was saying about the complete empathy failure, because, you know, sort of what I know is trans people are at huge risk if we're not included. If we're not included, it affects our mental health, and we're much more likely to be assaulted, we're more likely to be murdered. So, you know, we know that there is a real risk, especially to trans women, of assault, of murder, of hate crime, of higher suicide rates, all of those things, if trans women aren't treated as who they say they are, treated with respect and dignity. And there's loads and loads of evidence for that. Meanwhile, there is zero evidence of any risk attached to trans people being given civil rights. There's it's absolutely proven that trans people gaining civil rights causes no extra danger to anybody, including cis women, including children. There isn't an actual risk attached to trans people being treated with dignity and respect. But I always find it very interesting that, you know, sort of I'm seeing the results of this, and you know, trans people experiencing these high levels of assaults, trans people dying. I get to hear about that every day. And there is an absolute silence around, you know, concern for the well-being of trans people. It just doesn't register for people that we should be concerned that, you know, trans women are much more likely to be sexually assaulted than cis women. Trans women are much more likely to be murdered. Trans women are much more likely to sort of experience sort of worse mental health, and as proven because of the way they're treated. So our mental health is very contingent on how we're treated in society. And this sort of minority stress model, you know, is really well proven now. And yet people are still sort of saying, oh, well, trans people are mentally ill because they're trans. It's like, no, it's, you know, well established that it's because we're marginalized.
And I think it's really important, and I think that's where social media can be a real problem in terms of where people are getting their information and research and things like that, to kind of be up to date in terms of what is actually happening and what we know is kind of happening and how people are being marginalized and oppressed in different communities.
Yeah. But, and again, because trans people are infantilized, the sort of, and anybody who works with trans people is infantilized, you know, there's an enormous body of research, is so well established, and the transphobes have about 3 papers, all of which have been very, very carefully and well debunked, and yet our body of research counts for nothing because it's all seen as biased because it's pro-trans. So there's a sort of circular thing where people, it doesn't matter how much information you give people that's correct, they will still sort of lean on the far right, let's face it, information that there is so much of out there. And, you know, I think people's ability to see information as biased and propaganda is a little bit thin sometimes, because, yeah, I understand it, because if I go on YouTube, I can see, you know, if I'm looking up something trans related, the first, you know, sort of 20 videos will be telling me that lots of trans people detransition. That's not true, but that's what the first few, you know, or they'll be telling me that trans women are dangerous predators or whatever. So I get that, you know, algorithms online will lead people down a path of misinformation, but people have got to learn to be able to sift through that information and realise that it's propaganda.
And pushing a moral panic as well, feeds into people's you know, fears and all kinds of things with and it's not actually based in reality. Thank you for talking about that. This might link into some of those things we were talking about there, but I suppose, what do you think is the biggest challenge that the counseling and psychotherapy profession faces right now?
I was thinking if I could think of something else to say other than anti-oppressive practice, but I really can't, because I feel like this is actually at the heart of, you know, the political context we're in now is the social context we're in is alarmingly going towards the right, for whatever reason that happens. It's really sort of interesting psychologically to see people kind of following the herd on this, you know, quite scary path. You know, we've asked in the past sort of how do these things happen, and suddenly here they are happening, and we're seeing things like, you know, ethnic cleansing happening in our own country. You know, we've seen so many disabled people dying under government policy and people barely blinking about it. And I guess for me, the profession reflects the wider context, but, you know, we've always had a role to be countercultural, to help bring stuff into awareness for our clients and for our sort of corner of the world that maybe aren't being thought about and talked about. And it seems like if we're leaving all of that political context kind of out of the therapy room and out of the training room, then we are really failing to do our job, which is to really be awake. And what I think is particularly interesting is how many counsellors are quote unquote anti-woke. Because when you think about the word woke, it is about coming awake. It's about really noticing what's going on in the world. There's a wonderful word that comes from the Black community, and yet it's being used as a negative. And I find that really surprising. So I think that, yeah, our job probably as therapists is to wake up, to become woke.
It's not an additional or optional, even add-on, you know, that you then choose to do or not do. It should be embedded within all of the teaching and work that we do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I recently wrote the gender chapter for the SAGE Handbook of Counselling and Psychotherapy. And I did a deep dive into the way gender comes into sort of the evolution of the counselling profession. And I was looking at sort of our conception of the family and who is responsible for social problems, and the way sort of wider social contexts like class inequality and racism have been sort of scapegoated into individual communities. So instead of, like, if something goes wrong for somebody, it's the mum, it's the family, rather than it's the wider social context. It's class, it's sort of marginalization. And I found that really interesting, the way that, you know, sort of I was kind of taught, even as a person-centered therapist, there is this sort of low-level idea running in the background constantly in our profession of, if something went wrong, it was probably the mum. You know, ultimately it's how your family were, rather than the wider social context in which you grew up. And there's an incredible obliviousness to how much the wider social context that we grow up in impacts how we were raised, what it was like for our family, how much stress our family were under, and all of that stuff. So I find that really interesting, that just how oblivious we are to these really big systemic factors.
It's really interesting. I'm thinking about it from a person-centered point of view, and we do talk about interjected values, but then the focus tends to be then actually on the developmental process through the family and what went on with, like, the main caregivers. And as you say, we've got it there, but why don't we talk about it more, those broader kind of impacts, when it is there, we just don't focus on it. Yeah,
it's really interesting that we're almost there, but we don't quite get to the systemic level.
Sam, thank you so much. I could talk to you all day. It's been really absolutely fascinating. I suppose one last question is, what are your future plans or anything that you've got coming up next that you'd like to share with us?
Okay. Well, yeah, I've got this antioppressive practice e-learning that I'm working on. I've also got an essay on my website, which is sam-hope.co.uk, around antioppressive practice, which people might be interested in reading, which is about the sort of relational aspects of antioppressive practice. I'm doing some counsellor CPD in the new year that anyone can book onto, which is around gender diversity and neurodiversity. So the intersection of those two things. Well, the first one's the intersection of LGBTQA plus and neurodiversity. And the second one sort of focuses more closely on trans and autism, because that's something that people, I think, are particularly interested in knowing more about, which I will probably be putting information about on my website in due course. Which I'm hoping will be a supportive space for therapists to come together, and especially marginalised therapists. So I'm hoping that will be turning up in the near future as well.
That's amazing. Once you've got the full details, you can share them with us, and we can put them in the show notes so that people can access that if they're interested. Sam, good luck for the future, and thank you so much for being a guest on the Therapist Connect podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.
Take care. If you enjoyed this episode of the Therapist Connect podcast, please leave us a review on your favourite podcast platform.
Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by ISOS Connect. Modernise your private practice without tech overwhelm. Create and store client records and notes. Schedule video sessions with automated confirmations and reminders. Send invoices and more. All in one secure, affordable, and easy-to-use place. Visit www.isosconnect.com and use code TC30 for 1 month free on any paid plan.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.